welcome back to the Conservatarian Podcast. It has been another long minute since the last episode, but given the fact that South Carolina has recently held their statewide primaries, I figure now is the best time for me to jump back into this. A lot of news to report on. And in my view, the biggest news to report on is who the Democrat nominees are going to be for statewide races. Republican side, you know, it was pretty much guaranteed all the incumbents were going to win. So there's really no surprises there. The only interesting race on the Republican side really is the state superintendent, which we'll get to first. We're just sort of going to walk down the line here. I'm using the official South Carolina voter website, scvotes.org. You can see all the election results on there. So here, let's just jump into it. So, the race for the Democratic nominee for governor wasn't really talked about a whole lot. Which was interesting because this state has always been a state that Democrats would really like to flip. You know, they tried very hard to do so in 2020, obviously, with Lindsey Graham putting $100 million into the state. And Lindsey ended up coming out on top with 54-55% of the vote. So it didn't work, obviously. But, you know, I do think their best shot probably would be the governorship, just based off the power that teacher unions seem to have in the state. But anyway, let's get into it. So the two front runners for this race, right? There were five candidates, but there's two front runners. Former Congressman Joe Cunningham, who used to represent the 1st District, and State Senator Mia McLeod, or Mia McLeod. So they're both Democrats that have held seats in this state before, which obviously makes them good front runners, right? With Mia still holding her seat, Joe got beat out in 2020 by Nancy Mace. Ironic, after Joe beat Katie Arrington in the previous race in 2018. So it's kind of funny to see that seat flip back in the manner that it did. So Joe Cunningham pulled it off. He got the nomination, 56% of the vote. Mia came in second with 31%, an almost 50,000 vote difference between the two, with just under 180,000 votes in total in that Democratic nominee vote for governor. And on the Republican side, obviously, Henry McMaster won. His opponent really wasn't well known. A guy named Harrison Musselwhite, I believe also known as Trucker Bob or something to that effect. Bob got just over 60,000 votes, and McMaster got just over 300,000 votes. So he obviously won. 83% of the vote there went to McMaster, which is no surprise. And he really hasn't done anything that would upset the Republican base. If anything, I believe maybe the biggest complaint you could say is that Republicans wish that he would do more. That was certainly a complaint of mine. But, you know, as far as things that he's done that have personally upset me as a conservative libertarian voter, there really isn't a whole lot. I just wish he would do more, be kind of more of a Ron DeSantis or Kristi Noem style governor. But coffee, it is what it is, you know. So he pulled that off. Secretary of State, same deal. The incumbent Mark Hammond won by 75% of the vote, just over 250,000 votes. His opponent, Keith Blanford, getting just over 83,000 votes. Just over 337,000 votes cast in that race. That's one thing I found interesting, though, is when you look at the tallies for this, it's like, do certain people just not vote in seats they didn't pay attention to? So, like, everybody knows the governor, right? But then, like, people don't know who the Secretary of State is, so maybe that's why there's less of a vote count there. But on the other hand, people do know a little bit more who the Attorney General is, Because if we look at the vote tally here, it's 342,000 votes, just over, cast in that race. So it's more than Secretary of State, because people just know what the Attorney General is more than Secretary of State. So the Attorney General race on the Republican side had Alan Wilson and Lauren Martell running against each other. This race appears to be the closest one as far as having a clear winner. No, I take that back. It's not the closest one, but it's the closest, like, most important race that had a clear winner as far as statewide office. So Alan Wilson got 65% of the vote, almost 66, and Lauren Martell got 34% of the vote, with Alan getting just over 225,000 votes, Martell getting just over 117,000 votes. I think just a lot of people, at least in the Republican base, just weren't very happy with Wilson's response after the whole January 6th debacle, and probably wish that he had stuck by Trump more. But then on the other hand, Wilson also has done a fine job being the state attorney general, going after human trafficking in the state big time. If you follow the attorney general's page on Facebook, you'll see that they post very often about catching traffickers or pedophiles, sex offenders, all that kind of stuff, which was, you know, it's very good. I can commend him for that. He's done a good enough job. So, you know, there's really none of these statewide races that I'm really upset about. Even if I didn't vote for the incumbent, it's like, you know, it's still acceptable. I just voted for who I thought was the slightly more conservative candidate. But, you know, as to be expected, at least in a state like this, your more good old boy style Republicans are going to pull it off. Now back to the Democratic side here. I'm just going down the line. State Superintendent of Education, really wasn't a whole lot I heard about on this race, but there is a clear winner in this race on the Democrat side. To win a primary, you have to get majority vote, 50% of the vote. So somebody did. Lisa Ellis got 50% of the vote. Second place runner-up was Gary Burgess, and third place Jerry Govan. So it was just a three-way race there. The same cannot be said for the Republican side of the state superintendent of education vote, where I honestly thought the two front runners were going to be Ellen Weaver and Kizzy Gibson, because at least in my area of the state, the York County area, Kizzy Gibson seemed to be very popular, but surprisingly, she wasn't even in third place by the end of the race here. So your two front runners in the race who are now going on to a primary runoff election are Kathy Manis and Ellen Weaver, with Kathy getting 102,000, just over 102,000 votes. Ellen Weaver in second place with 77,000 votes. And the rest of the candidates didn't even get 50,000 votes as far as that goes. So it's going to be interesting to see what there being six candidates in the race, and that now reduced to two for the runoff coming up, where the voters of the other candidates, how they're going to split their votes. Ellen Weaver was endorsed by a lot of respectable state senators in the area. Wes Clymer, Josh Kimbrell, Greg Hembree, endorsed by a few of our congressmen, Ralph Norman, Jeff Duncan. So I think that definitely boosted her up. But evidently Kathy Manis, she was endorsed by our former state superintendent, who decided not to run again. Well, I shouldn't say former. I believe she's still in until the election is held. But Molly Spearman endorsed Kathy Manis, so that definitely gave her some of a boost too. But, you know, at this point, the race can still go either way. Kathy got 30% of the vote. Ellen Weaver got 23% of the vote. And just based off of my observations, I want to say that the other four candidates definitely pulled voters away who would have otherwise gone to Ellen Weaver, is the way I see that race. Again, on the Republican side, you got Commissioner of Agriculture. Really wasn't a well-known, you know, it's not something that I think a lot of people look at and say that's really important, and although it obviously is. Once again, the incumbent in that race won. Hugh Weathers, 59% of the vote. Second place runner-up, Bill Bledsoe, who, if you remember, ran for the Senate seat in 2020 in the last election, decided to throw his hat back in the ring. But still cannot pull it off. But his name recognition definitely is what got him the second place position there in that race. Now, back to something once again interesting, where there's going to be yet another runoff, is the Democratic nominee for the United States Senate seat here, who's going to run against Tim Scott. So, right now, first place, looks like first place is going to Catherine Fleming Bruce, who has 34% of the vote, almost 35%. And second place is Crystal Matthews at 33%. And third place is Angela Getter, also at 32%. All these candidates are within a few thousand votes of each other, so this was obviously a very contested race. Not one that I really looked into a whole lot or heard a whole lot about. I don't think I've seen a single yard sign for any of these candidates, at least in my area, but that's kind of to be expected. I live in a more conservative Republican part of the state, so it's going to be interesting to see who pulls that off. Ultimately, I don't think the candidate who wins this primary is going to win the general election. I believe Tim Scott is the far more popular senator from South Carolina. Tim Scott is generally more conservative than Lindsey Graham is. Graham is still more of a moderate kind of candidate. But interesting to see, regardless, see what kind of candidate your Democrat base is trying to put up and who they think can pull it off. Now we get to the big stuff. The Republican primary for District 1. As everyone knows, this was a very contested seat. Trump endorsed Nancy Mace's opponent, Katie Arrington, who beat out Mark Sanford in the primary in 2018 in a surprise upset victory. But then she went on to lose the general election against Joe Cunningham. So, this race, Nancy Mace ended up in the bad graces of President Trump because of some comments she made about him being responsible for January 6th. And ultimately, I don't agree with Trump on this one. Nancy Mace has generally been a pretty decent conservative, libertarian-style Republican, and she's popular in her district. The Republicans in District 1 are a very different kind of Republican than, like, in the district I'm in, District 5. You know, you look at Ralph Norman, then look at Nancy Mace, you can see the difference of what kind of candidate that those districts want. And the best way to win those districts is not necessarily to always get the most conservative or the most partisan style candidate, but I think ultimately Nancy Mace was the best candidate to run in District 1, and she won her primary. She got 52% of the vote. There's only a 5,000 vote difference between her and Katie Arrington, who got 45%. And then there was a third candidate in the race, Lynn Piper Loomis, but she dropped out during a debate and endorsed Katie Arrington on the spot. It appears she still showed up on the ballot, though, getting 870 votes. That's kind of interesting to see. But I do think Nancy Mace winning that primary is probably going to end up being a good thing. Probably going to be able to hold that seat. I believe with redistricting, it's actually a slightly more Republican-leaning seat, although still competitive. But I do believe Nancy Mace is the best shot at keeping that seat, a red one, and I kind of hope that Trump and Mace put the past behind them, because this next election is going to be very important. Also, District 4 in the state, apparently, the primary was surprisingly competitive. You had William Timmons, he's the current Republican sitting in that seat, he's the incumbent. He got 52% of the vote. And second place runner-up got 23%, and he really wasn't It really wasn't making a whole lot of noise here in this state, but it was surprisingly very competitive. There was four candidates running against Timmons, including Michael LaPierre, who, if you remember, ran against Lindsey Graham in the primary. So we're seeing a lot of people that ran in previous primaries once again toss their hats into the ring this go round. It looks like it's not really paying off for much of them. Very important to me now is District 5, who's going to run against Ralph Norman. Both candidates were very progressive style Democrats, which is once again an interesting choice. It's like when Mo Brown ran against Ralph Norman last go round as a progressive style candidate. This district is not, you know, we are a very conservative district. If a Democrat wants to make some leeway, they're going to have to run as a moderate. And the people that run against Ralph just simply do not do that. That's a very interesting choice. But the winner here in this primary, Evangeline Hundley, 57% of the vote, just over 11,000 votes. And Ralph Norman, nobody ran against him, so he obviously won his primary. District 6, no surprise, Jim Clyburn won. It's going to be a very easy Democratic hold, although I wouldn't be surprised if the win is not as big of a margin as they would hope for in that seat. Back to the other big competitive race in the state is Tom Rice's seat, District 7. Tom Rice was one of 10 Republicans to vote to impeach Trump, and his vote was the most surprising out of all the candidates, because Tom Rice was generally seen as a very conservative candidate, somebody who was very much, you know, in line with Trump and the party line, and yet he voted to impeach Trump. He said it was a vote of conscience, and his vote of conscience just lost him his primary. Russell Fry, the Trump-endorsed candidate here, won out the primary, 51% of the vote, to Tom Rice's 24%. Russell Fry getting just over 43,000 votes, Tom Rice getting just over 20,000 votes. This race went about how I expected it. Once again, the difference in these districts, District 7 being a much more conservative district, has more of those kind of voters that would more care about Trump's endorsement in this race. So ultimately, Russell Fry won out. Although that's not to say that Russell Fry was my preferred candidate. I was rooting for Graham Allen when he was running before he dropped out and Trump endorsed Russell Fry. We'll see what happens. Hopefully he can be a good congressman in this state, but generally from what I hear, people really didn't understand why Trump decided to endorse Russell Fry instead of a candidate like Graham Allen. But you know, it is what it is. And then just a quick personal thing with redistricting, now I find myself in a new state house seat. We were previously in District 45 under Brandon Newton. Now we are in District 43. So this race was very competitive in this area. We had Randy Leegan, the incumbent. And then you had a newcomer, Mark Corral, throw his hat in the ring. Definitely a more self-described conservative slash libertarian style candidate who ran a terrific grassroots campaign. Tons of mail-in flyers, tons of door knocking, just from personal experience, everyone in this area had their doors knocked by Mark Corral's people, sometimes more than once. And that is ultimately the candidate that my family and I chose to support. Compared to Leegan, there's nothing really wrong with Leegan per se, just more of a moderate style candidate, kind of one of the good old boys, and we just wanted to support somebody new and fresh to get a new perspective in office. And ultimately we decided we'd take a chance on Mark, as did many other people. And honestly, we thought Mark had the energy to pull this off. Everything leading up to the primary election day pretty much signaled Mark was gonna win. by a somewhat decent margin, but as I'm seeing here, with all counties reporting in this district, Randy Ligon still pulled it off. 51% of the vote, almost 52%, and Mark Rao, 48%. Randy Ligon pulled it off by 141 votes. It was a very tough race, and I would not be surprised if Mark Rao throws his hat back in the ring in 2024 to run against Ligon once again, or throw his hat back in the ring in some other fashion. He was still a very popular candidate regardless of the outcome of this, and ultimately Ligon is going to end up winning the seat. Once again, it's a very conservative seat, so this pretty much just determined the winner of the seat. So Randy Ligon, congratulations on pulling it off. With him being the incumbent, he obviously had enough people that voted for him previously that were comfortable with things he'd done. You know, they know him personally, and they voted for him again. And then you had people like me and my family, new to this district, that didn't have that kind of support for him. So for us, we started out from scratch and made the decision to support Corral. And, you know, we only lost by 141 votes, so better luck next time. So, in other news, last night there was also a special election in Texas's 34th Congressional District, in which Republican Myra Flores managed to flip a seat that has been under Democratic control for decades. This was a district that was D+5, and she flipped it outright. There were four candidates in the race, and she received 51% of the vote. This was a very important race to Republicans. They put a good bit of money into this race to ensure that Myra came out on top. And as a fun tidbit here, with her being now the first Republican to hold the seat in forever, pretty much, she's also the first sitting congresswoman to have been born in Mexico. So how's that for diversity, folks? The big problem, though, would be seeing if she can continue to hold the seat in the official 2022 elections in the midterms, because that election will use the newly drawn district lines, where the district will now be moved from a D+5 to a D+15 seat. So it will not be impossible for her to win, but it's definitely going to be more of an uphill battle than the special election was. But nonetheless, this is great news. And we also learned from Elon Musk that this was the first time that he voted for a Republican candidate. He lives in that district, and he voted for Myra Flores. And just looking at polls and the way things are going, inflation is rampant, gas prices, need I say more? Just the economy is not an issue that Democrats can run on right now, and the economy is like the number one issue for moderate centrist voters, your independent voters, and the only people really campaigning on doing anything about this is the Republican Party. So you're seeing a lot of center-left, moderate, independent-style people saying they're going to vote Republican for the first time. And this just all points to there being a red wave in 2022. But, you know, it all depends on voter turnout at the end of the day, how many people are going to actually go out there and cast their ballots. But this is going to be a very important midterm if Republicans can take back the House and take back at least one Senate seat and regain the majority in the Senate. They won't be able to necessarily push a legislative agenda, but they can definitely do things to hold the administration to account with congressional hearings, all that kind of stuff. At the very least, they can bring bills forward and they can pass them. And if Biden vetoes them, then at least they still have on record, hey, we passed this legislation, Biden vetoed it. Do you want us to be able to do more? We need a Republican president in 2024. And, you know, I'm just I'm still a little worrisome about this. I feel like people are just assuming it's going to be a red wave without a whole lot of thought into it, but it's really going to be dependent upon Republicans getting out there and voting and doing their best to turn independents to the party, to turn estranged Democrats to the party. And it's trying to get out there and make a huge impact in people that ordinarily just wouldn't vote for us. Once again, turning back to that Texas special election, that district is like 84% Hispanic, and they voted for a Republican. Now, granted, the candidate they voted for was also Hispanic, literally born in Mexico, but you need to start. I believe our best shot is to appeal more to Hispanic voters, which is something we've seen happening. There was a border town, also mostly Hispanic, and they voted for a Republican mayor. So maybe this is a sign that Texas is getting redder, or people are just fed up. I mean, this doesn't necessarily mean that a very conservative Republican is going to be able to win in these more moderate districts, but it means, I believe, if you get the right kind of Republican running, like Glenn Youngkin in Virginia, you need to be able to appeal to a broad base while still having some conservative values, obviously as a Republican. But if you can do that, you can win a lot of these seats where people are disenfranchised. I mean, look at San Francisco. They recalled a district attorney down there overwhelmingly, and those are liberal voters, and they recalled them. Or look at that school board meeting too. They recalled a lot of voters there. I mean, a lot of board members there, I believe it was three of them they recalled. Once again, in very liberal San Francisco, it's because people are tired of laws not being enforced, they're tired of agendas being pushed down their kids' throats, and they're tired of paying $5 for gas. Gas climbed up 35 cents about a week ago, just overnight, in this area. That was insane. And, you know, prices are going up. Just me working at Food Lion, and I see the prices go up, and, you know, when we have to put up new price tags, I'm like, wow, really? This is going up? And it's like, it's almost everything in our department is going up, and wages are not going up, and inflation at the rate that it's going, people are going to be hurting, and I think we're definitely going to be seeing a recession very soon. I kind of think that we're sort of in the early beginning stages of one, and it's a shame, is what it is. It's a huge shame, and you got a lot of Biden voters definitely regretting their votes. This is not what they signed up for. They voted for Biden because he ran as a moderate, and he really hasn't done anything moderate. I mean, what's Congress doing? They're debating gun control bills right now. Absolutely nothing on energy, on lowering gas prices. Lowering gas prices in and of itself will help take care of a lot of this inflation. A lot of this inflation right now is being driven by high gas prices. And people say, oh, it's Putin. It's not Putin. We were energy independent under Trump. Energy independent. We were exporting oil and gas to other countries. Exporting it. And now we're back to relying on other countries who, by the way, have dirtier oil and gas than we did, because we innovate and we made it cleaner. We had the cleanest oil and gas out of any other country, and we stopped using ours, and we started going back to the Middle East and Russia, who export dirtier oil and gas than we do. It's backwards. They don't care about energy is the problem. It's about the appearance of caring, but they don't care. Because if they did, they would open our stuff back up. Another complaint I've heard people saying, oh, Biden closing that pipeline had nothing to do with rising gas prices. The pipeline wasn't even finished. It's about market expectations. You get a president in the office who says they don't support fracking, right? They don't support oil and gas. They support all these green energy alternatives. If you actually look at it, gas prices started going up a little bit right after Joe Biden was elected because the market sees what's going to happen. You get a president in office who says they're going to do such and such to such and such industry. The industry is going to have to start making some changes. And now we're seeing the repercussions of that. This could all be turned around in a day. Biden can whip out his pen, sign some executive orders, and we'd start seeing things turn around a little bit, but it's not going to happen. Instead, people are going to continue to point the finger at each other, saying, oh, it's because Republicans didn't vote for this price gouging bill. It's like, for one, who is the government to determine what price gouging is? You know, you're just going to start blaming everything on the oil and gas companies instead of your energy policies. Your energy policies that are forcing these gas companies to charge so much, forcing these gas stations to charge so much. No, take some responsibility, admit you were wrong, and correct course. Instead of them backing up, right, and going more moderate, like Bill Clinton did, right, they're doubling down, and it makes literally no sense. Why would you double down on unpopular positions? I really don't see what they think the American people think. You know, they're doubling down on all this crazy ideological stuff when people right now are caring about their wallets and their kids and crime in this country. Those are the three issues that Republicans should be running on, and quite frankly, old school Democrats need to be running on. We need people to start running who actually care about the things the American people are facing. Not to say that they need to agree with me as a conservatarian, but they need to care and actually care and show initiative and be willing to work towards something. And right now we're just not seeing that from Congress. Not seeing it whatsoever. And it's a shame. And not just Congress, but state legislatures, county councils, city councils, we need this across the board. We need average Americans to start throwing their hats in the ring and saying, hey, this is what I'm seeing, and maybe I don't know as much as somebody else does, but I know common sense, and I know how to work towards something, so that's a start, and that's what we really need right now. But, you know, things aren't going to change until a large majority of Americans start to realize what's actually going on with how these policies that, the current Democratic Party is pushing. They're just not working. And with that, I think that's really all that needs to be said for this episode. Nice long episode for y'all to enjoy. So, thank you for listening to the Conservatarian Podcast. Please, leave a review. Tell me what you want to hear me talk about next. My opinions on things, the way I see things going, or tell me your opinions, and I'll tell you my opinion on your opinion. How about that? But once again, thanks for tuning into the podcast, and if you actually have been listening, wow, that's amazing. You listen to some random 21-year-old ramble on in his bedroom on a microphone. But once again, just thanks for listening, and I'll see you guys next time on the Conservatarian Podcast.